but he survived. Most people in his situation do not. Here, then, is the fundamental puzzle of modern medical care. You have a desperately sick patient, and in order to have a chance of saving him, you have to get the knowledge right, and then you have to make sure that the 178 daily tasks that follow are done correctly, despite some monitor's alarm going off for God knows what reason, despite the patient in the next bed crashing, despite a nurse poking his head around the curtain to ask whether someone could help get this lady's chest open. There is complexity upon complexity. And even specialization has begun to seem inadequate. So what do you do? The medical profession's answer has been to go from specialization to super specialization. I told DeFilippo's ICU story, for instance, as if I were the one tending to him hour by hour. That, however, was actually an intensivist, as intensive care specialists like to be called. As a general surgeon, I like to think I can handle most clinical situations. But as the intricacies involved in intensive care have grown, responsibility has increasingly shifted to super specialists. In the past decade, training programs focusing on critical care have opened in most major American and European cities, and half of American ICUs now rely on super specialists. Expertise is the mantra of modern medicine. In the early 20th century, you needed only a high school diploma and a one-year medical degree to practice medicine. By the century's end, all doctors had to have a college degree, a four-year medical degree, and an additional 3 to 7 years of residency training in an individual field of practice: pediatrics, surgery, neurology, or the like. In recent years, though, even this level of preparation has not been enough for the new complexity of medicine. After their residencies, most young doctors today are going on to do fellowships, adding 1 to 3 further years of training in, say, laparoscopic surgery, or pediatric metabolic disorders, or breast radiology, or critical care. A young doctor is not so young nowadays. You typically don't start in independent practice until your mid-30s. We live in the era of the super specialists, of clinicians who have taken the time to practice, practice, practice at one narrow thing until they can do it better than anyone else. They have two advantages over ordinary specialists: greater knowledge of the details that matter, and a learned ability to handle the complexities of the particular job. There are degrees of complexity, though, and medicine and other fields like it have grown so far beyond the usual kind that avoiding daily mistakes is proving impossible, even for our most super-specialized. There is perhaps no field that has taken specialization further than surgery. Think of the operating room as a particularly aggressive intensive care unit. We have anesthesiologists just to handle pain control and patient stability, and even they have divided into subcategories. There are pediatric anesthesiologists, cardiac anesthesiologists, obstetric anesthesiologists, neurosurgical anesthesiologists, and many others. Likewise, we no longer have just operating room nurses. They too are often subspecialized for specific kinds of cases. Then, of course, there are the surgeons. Surgeons are so absurdly ultra-specialized that when we joke about right-ear surgeons and left-ear surgeons, we have to check to be sure they don't exist. I am trained as a general surgeon, but except in the most rural places, there is no such thing. You really can't do everything anymore. I decided to center my practice on surgical oncology, cancer surgery, but even this proved too broad. So although I have done all I can to hang on to a broad span of general surgical skills, especially for emergencies, I've developed a particular expertise in removing cancers of endocrine glands. The result of the recent decades of ever-refined specialization has been a spectacular improvement in surgical capability and success. Where deaths were once a double-digit risk of even small operations, and prolonged recovery and disability was the norm, day surgery has become commonplace. Yet given how much surgery is now done, Americans today undergo an average of 7 operations in their lifetime. With surgeons performing more than 50 million operations per year, the amount of harm remains substantial. We continue to have upwards of 150,000 surgical deaths annually, more than 3 times the number of road traffic fatalities. Moreover, research has consistently showed that at least half our deaths and major complications are avoidable. The knowledge exists. But however supremely specialized and trained we may have become, steps are still missed. Mistakes are still made. Medicine, with its dazzling successes but also frequent failures, therefore poses a significant challenge. What do you do when expertise is not enough? What do you do when even the super specialists fail? We've begun to see an answer, but it has come from an unexpected source, one that has nothing to do with medicine at all. Chapter 2. The Checklist. On October 30, 1935, at Wright Airfield in Dayton, Ohio, the U.S. Army Air Corps held a flight competition for airplane manufacturers vying to build the military's next-generation long-range bomber. It wasn't supposed to be much of a competition. In early evaluations, the Boeing Corporation's gleaming aluminum alloy Model 299 had trounced the designs of Martin and Douglas. Boeing's plane could carry 5 times as many bombs as the Army had requested. It could fly faster than previous bombers and almost twice as far. A Seattle newspaper man who had glimpsed the plane on a test flight over his city called it the Flying Fortress, and the name stuck. The flight competition, according to the military historian Philip Meilinger, was regarded as a mere formality. The Army planned to order at least 65 of the aircraft. A small crowd of Army brass and manufacturing executives watched as the Model 299 test plane taxied onto the runway. It was sleek and impressive, with a 103-foot wingspan and 4 engines jutting out from the wings, rather than the usual 2. The plane roared down the tarmac, lifted off smoothly, and climbed sharply to 300 feet. Then it stalled, turned on one wing, and crashed in a fiery explosion. 2 of the 5 crew members died, including the pilot, Major Ployer P. Hill. An investigation revealed that nothing mechanical had gone wrong. The crash had been due to pilot error, the report said. Substantially more complex than previous aircraft, the new plane required the pilot to attend to the 4 engines, each with its own oil-fuel mix, the retractable landing gear, the wing flaps, electric trim tabs that needed adjustment to maintain stability at different airspeeds, and constant speed propellers, whose pitch had to be regulated with hydraulic controls, among other features. While doing all this, Hill had forgotten to release a new locking mechanism on the elevator and rudder controls. The Boeing model was deemed, as a newspaper put it, too much airplane for one man to fly. The Army Air Corps declared Douglas's smaller design the winner. Boeing nearly went bankrupt. Still, the Army purchased a few aircraft from Boeing as test planes, and some insiders remained convinced that the aircraft was flyable. So a group of test pilots got together and considered what to do. What they decided not to do was almost as interesting as what they actually did. They did not require Model 299 pilots to undergo longer training. It was hard to imagine having more experience and expertise than Major Hill, who had been the Air Corps Chief of Flight Testing. Instead, they came up with an ingeniously simple approach. They created a pilot's checklist. Its mere existence indicated how far aeronautics had advanced. In the early years of flight, getting an aircraft into the air might have been nerve-wracking, but it was hardly complex. Using a checklist for takeoff would no more have occurred to a pilot than to a driver backing a car out of the garage. But flying this new plane was too complicated to be left to the memory of any one person, however expert. The test pilots made their list simple, brief, and to the point. Short enough to fit on an index card with step-by-step checks for takeoff, flight, landing, and taxiing. It had the kind of stuff that all pilots know to do. They check that the brakes are released, that the instruments are set, that the door and windows are closed, that the elevator controls are unlocked. Dumb stuff. You wouldn't think it would make that much difference. But with the checklist in hand, the pilots went on to fly the Model 299 a total of 1.8 million miles without one accident. The Army ultimately ordered almost 13,000 of the aircraft, which it dubbed the B-17. And because flying the behemoth was now possible, the Army gained a decisive air advantage in the Second World War, enabling its devastating bombing campaign across Nazi Germany. Much of our work today has entered its own B-17 phase. Substantial parts of what software designers, financial managers, firefighters, police officers, lawyers, and most certainly clinicians do are now too complex for them to carry out reliably from memory alone. Multiple fields, in other words, have become too much airplane for one person to fly. Yet it is far from obvious that something as simple as a checklist could be of substantial help. We may admit that errors and oversights occur, even devastating ones. But we believe our jobs are too complicated to reduce to a checklist. Sick people, for instance, are phenomenally more various than airplanes. A study of 41,000 trauma patients in the state of Pennsylvania, just trauma patients, found that they had 1,224 different injury-related diagnoses in 32,261 unique combinations. That's like having 32,261 kinds of airplane to land. Mapping out the proper steps for every case is not possible, and physicians have been skeptical that a piece of paper with a bunch of little boxes would improve matters. But we have had glimmers that it might, at least in some corners. What, for instance, are the vital signs that every hospital records, if not a kind of checklist? Comprised of four physiological data points: body temperature, pulse, blood pressure, and respiratory rate. They give health professionals a basic picture of how sick a person is. Missing one of these measures can be dangerous, we've learned. Maybe three of them seem normal. The patient looks good, actually, and you're inclined to say, she's fine, send her home. But perhaps the fourth reveals a fever or low blood pressure or a galloping heart rate, and skipping it could cost a person her life. Practitioners have had the means to measure vital signs since the early 20th century, after the mercury thermometer became commonplace, and the Russian physician, Nikolai Karatkov, demonstrated how to use an inflatable sleeve and stethoscope to quantify blood pressure. But although using the four signs together as a group gauged the condition of patients more accurately than using any of them singly, clinicians do not reliably record them all. In a complex environment, experts are up against two main difficulties. The first is the fallibility of human memory and attention, especially when it comes to mundane, routine matters that are easily overlooked under the strain of more pressing events. When you've got a patient throwing up and an upset family member asking you what's going on, it can be easy to forget that you have not checked her pulse. Faulty memory and distraction are a particular danger in what engineers call all-or-none processes. Whether running to the store to buy ingredients for a cake, preparing an airplane for takeoff, or evaluating a sick person in the hospital, if you miss just one key thing, you might as well not have made the effort at all. A further difficulty, just as insidious, is that people can lull themselves into skipping steps even when they remember them. In complex processes, after all, certain steps don't always matter. Perhaps the elevator controls on airplanes are usually unlocked and a check is pointless most of the time. Perhaps measuring all four vital signs uncovers a worrisome issue in only one out of 50 patients. This has never been a problem before, people say. Until one day, it is. Checklists seem to provide protection against such failures. They remind us of the minimum necessary steps and make them explicit. They not only offer the possibility of verification, but also instill a kind of discipline of higher performance, which is precisely what happened with vital signs, though it was not doctors who deserved the credit. The routine recording of the four vital signs did not become the norm in Western hospitals until the 1960s, when nurses embraced the idea. They designed their patient charts and forms to include the signs, essentially creating a checklist for themselves. With all the things nurses had to do for their patients over the course of a day or night, dispense their medications, dress their wounds, troubleshoot problems, the vitals chart provided a way of ensuring that every 6 hours, or more often when nurses judge necessary, they didn't forget to check their patient's pulse, blood pressure, temperature, and respiration, and assess exactly how the patient was doing. In most hospitals, nurses have since added a fifth vital sign, pain, as rated by patients on a scale of 1 to 10. And nurses have developed yet further such bedside innovations. For example, medication timing charts and brief written care plans for every patient. No one calls these checklists, but really, that's what they are. They have been welcomed by nursing, but haven't quite carried over into doctoring. Charts and checklists, that's nursing stuff. Boring stuff. They are nothing what we doctors, with our extra years of training and specialization, would ever need or use. In 2001, though, a critical care specialist at Johns Hopkins Hospital named Peter Pronovost decided to give a doctor checklist a try. He didn't attempt to make the checklist encompass everything ICU teams might need to do in a day. He designed it to tackle just one of their hundreds of potential tasks, the one that nearly killed Anthony DiFilippo, central line infections. On a sheet of plain paper, he plotted out the steps to take in order to avoid infections when putting in a central line. Doctors are supposed to 1. Wash their hands with soap, 2. Clean the patient's skin with chlorhexidine antiseptic, 3. Put sterile drapes over the entire patient, 4. Wear a mask, hat, sterile gown, and gloves, and 5. Put a sterile dressing over the insertion site once the line is in. Check, 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 check. These steps are no-brainers. They have been known and taught for years. So it seems silly to make a checklist for something so obvious. Still, Pronovost asked the nurses in his ICU to observe the doctors for a month as they put lines into patients and record how often they carried out each step. In more than a third of patients, they skipped at least one. The next month, he and his team persuaded the Johns Hopkins Hospital Administration to authorize nurses to stop doctors if they saw them skipping a step on the checklist. Nurses were also to ask the doctors each day whether any lines ought to be removed, so as not to leave them in longer than necessary. This was revolutionary. Nurses have always had their ways of nudging a doctor into doing the right thing, ranging from the gentle reminder, did you forget to put on your mask, doctor? To more forceful methods. I have had a nurse body check me when she thought I hadn't put enough drapes on a patient. But many nurses aren't sure whether this is their place or whether a given measure is worth the confrontation. Does it really matter whether a patient's legs are draped for a line going into the chest? The new rule made it clear. If doctors didn't follow every step precisely, the nurses would have backup from the administration to intervene. For a year afterward, Pronovost and his colleagues monitored what happened. The results were so dramatic that they weren't sure whether to believe them. The 10-day line infection rate went from 11% to zero. So they followed patients for 15 more months. Only 2 line infections occurred during the entire period. They calculated that, in this one hospital, the checklist had prevented 43 infections and 8 deaths and saved $2 million in costs. Pronovost recruited more colleagues, and they tested some more checklists in his Johns Hopkins ICU. One aimed to ensure that nurses observed patients for pain at least once every 4 hours and provided timely pain medication. This reduced from 41% to 3% the likelihood of a patient's enduring untreated pain. They tested a checklist for patients on mechanical ventilation, making sure, for instance, that doctors prescribed antacid medication to prevent stomach ulcers and that the head of each patient's bed was propped up at least 30 degrees to stop oral secretions from going into the windpipe. The proportion of patients not receiving the recommended care dropped from 70% to 4%. The occurrence of pneumonias fell by a quarter, and 21 fewer patients died than in the previous year. The researchers found that simply having the doctors and nurses in the ICU create their own checklists for what they thought should be done each day improved the consistency of care to the point that the average length of patient stay in intensive care dropped by half. These checklists accomplished what checklists elsewhere have done, Pronovost observed. They helped with memory recall and clearly set out the minimum necessary steps in a process. He was surprised to discover how often even experienced personnel failed to grasp the importance of certain precautions. In a survey of ICU staff taken before introducing the ventilator checklists, he found that half hadn't realized that evidence strongly supported giving ventilated patients antacid medication. Checklists, he found, established a higher standard of baseline performance. These seem, of course, ridiculously primitive insights. Pronovost is routinely described by colleagues as brilliant, inspiring, a genius. He has an MD and a PhD in public health from Johns Hopkins and is trained in emergency medicine, anesthesiology, and critical care medicine. But really, does it take all that to figure out what anyone who has made a to-do list figured out ages ago? Well, maybe yes. Despite his initial checklist results, takers were slow to come. He traveled around the country showing his checklists to doctors, nurses, insurers, employers, anyone who would listen. He spoke in an average of 7 cities a month, but few adopted the idea. There were various reasons. Some physicians were offended by the suggestion that they needed checklists. Others had legitimate doubts about Pronovost's evidence. So far, he'd shown only that checklists worked in one hospital, Johns Hopkins, where the ICUs have money, plenty of staff, and Peter Pronovost walking the hallways to make sure that the idea was being properly implemented. How about in the real world, where ICU nurses and doctors are in short supply, pressed for time, overwhelmed with patients, and hardly receptive to the notion of filling out yet another piece of paper? In 2003, however, the Michigan Health and Hospital Association approached Pronovost about testing his central line checklist throughout the state's ICUs. It would be a huge undertaking. But at last, Pronovost would have a chance to establish whether his checklists could really work in the wider world. I visited Sinai Grace Hospital in inner-city Detroit a few years after the project was underway, and I saw what Pronovost was up against. Occupying a campus of red brick buildings amid abandoned houses, check cashing stores, and wig shops on the city's west side, just south of 8 Mile Road, Sinai Grace is a classic urban hospital. It employed at the time 800 physicians, 700 nurses, and 2,000 other medical personnel to care for a population with the lowest median income of any city in the country. More than 250,000 residents were uninsured. 300,000 were on state assistance. That meant chronic financial problems. Sinai Grace is not the most cash-strapped hospital in the city. That would be Detroit Receiving Hospital, where more than 1/5 of the patients have no means of payment. But between 2000 and 2003, Sinai Grace and 8 other Detroit hospitals were forced to cut a third of their staff, and the state had to come forward with a $50 million bailout to avert their bankruptcy. Sinai Grace has 5 ICUs for adult patients and 1 for infants. Hassan Mackey, the director of intensive care, told me what it was like there in 2004, when Pronovost and the Hospital Association started a series of mailings and conference calls with hospitals to introduce checklists for central lines and ventilator patients. Morale was low, he said. We had lost lots of staff, and the nurses who remained weren't sure if they were staying. Many doctors were thinking about leaving, too. Meanwhile, the teams faced an even heavier workload because of new rules limiting how long the residents could work at a stretch. Now Pronovost was telling them to find the time to fill out some daily checklists. Tom Piskorowski, one of the ICU physicians, told me his reaction. Forget the paperwork. Take care of the patient. I accompanied a team on 7 a.m. rounds through one of the surgical ICUs. It had 11 patients. 4 had gunshot wounds. 1 had been shot in the chest. 1 had been shot through the bowel, kidney, and liver. 2 had been shot through the neck and left quadriplegic. 5 patients had cerebral hemorrhaging. 3 were 79 years and older and had been injured falling downstairs. 1 was a middle-aged man whose skull and left temporal lobe had been damaged by an assault with a blunt weapon. And 1 was a worker who had become paralyzed from the neck down after falling 25 feet off a ladder onto his head. There was a cancer patient recovering from surgery to remove part of his lung, and a patient who had had surgery to repair a cerebral aneurysm. The doctors and nurses on rounds tried to proceed methodically from one room to the next, but were constantly interrupted. A patient they'd thought they'd stabilized began hemorrhaging again. Another who had been taken off the ventilator developed trouble breathing and had to be put back on the machine. It was hard to imagine that they could get their heads far enough above the daily tide of disasters to worry about the minutiae on some checklist. Yet there they were, I discovered, filling out those pages. Mostly, it was the nurses who kept things in order. Each morning, a senior nurse walked through the unit, clipboard in hand, making sure that every patient on a ventilator had the bed propped at the right angle and had been given the right medicines and the right tests.
Whenever doctors put in a central line, a nurse made sure that the central line checklist had been filled out and placed in the patient's chart.
Looking back through the hospital files, I found that they had been doing this faithfully for more than 3 years. Pronovost had been canny when he started. In his first conversations with hospital administrators, he hadn't ordered them to use the central line checklist. Instead, he asked them simply to gather data on their own line infection rates. In early 2004, they found, the infection rates for ICU patients in Michigan hospitals were higher than the national average, and in some hospitals, dramatically so. Sinai Grace experienced more central line infections than 75% of American hospitals. Meanwhile, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan agreed to give hospitals small bonus payments for participating in Pronovost's program.
A checklist suddenly seemed an easy and logical thing to try.
In what became known as the Keystone Initiative, each hospital assigned a project manager to roll out the checklist and participate in a twice-monthly conference call with Pronovost for troubleshooting. Pronovost also insisted that the participating hospitals assign to each unit a senior hospital executive who would visit at least once a month, hear the staff's complaints, and help them solve problems. The executives were reluctant. They normally lived in meetings, worrying about strategy and budgets. They weren't used to venturing into patient territory and didn't feel they belonged there. In some places, they encountered hostility, but their involvement proved crucial. In the first month, the executives discovered that chlorhexidine soap, shown to reduce line infections, was available in less than a third of the ICUs. This was a problem only an executive could solve. Within weeks, every ICU in Michigan had a supply of the soap. Teams also complained to the hospital officials that although the checklist required patients be fully covered with a sterile drape when lines were being put in, full-size drapes were often unavailable. So the officials made sure that drapes were stocked. Then they persuaded Aero International, one of the largest manufacturers of central lines, to produce a new kit that had both the drape and chlorhexidine in it. In December 2006, the Keystone Initiative published its findings in a landmark article in the New England Journal of Medicine. Within the first 3 months of the project, the central line infection rate in Michigan's ICUs decreased by 66%. Most ICUs, including the ones at Sinai Grace Hospital, cut their quarterly infection rate to zero. Michigan's infection rates fell so low that its average ICU outperformed 90% of ICUs nationwide. In the Keystone Initiative's first 18 months, the hospital saved an estimated $175 million in costs and more than 1,500 lives. The successes have been sustained for several years now, all because of a stupid little checklist. It is tempting to think that this might be an isolated success. Perhaps there is something unusual about the strategy required to prevent central line infections. After all, the central line checklist did not prevent any of the other kinds of complications that can result from sticking these foot-long plastic catheters into people's chests, such as a collapsed lung if the needle goes in too deep, or bleeding if a blood vessel gets torn. It just prevented infections. In this particular instance, yes, doctors had some trouble getting the basics right, making sure to wash their hands, put on their sterile gloves and gown, and so on, and a checklist proved dramatically valuable. But among the myriad tasks clinicians carry out for patients, maybe this is the peculiar case. I started to wonder, though. Around the time I learned of Pronovost's results, I spoke to Marcus Thalman, the cardiac surgeon who had been the lead author of the case report on the extraordinary rescue of the little girl from death by drowning. Among the many details that intrigued me about the save was the fact that it occurred not at a large cutting-edge academic medical center, but at an ordinary community hospital. This one was in Klagenfurt, a small provincial Austrian town in the Alps nearest to where the girl had fallen in the pond. I asked Thalman how the hospital had managed such a complicated rescue. He told me he had been working in Klagenfurt for 6 years when the girl came in. She had not been the first person whom he and his colleagues had tried to revive from cardiac arrest after hypothermia and suffocation. His hospital received between 3 and 5 such patients a year, he estimated, mostly avalanche victims, some of them drowning victims, and a few of them people attempting suicide by taking a drug overdose and then wandering out into the snowy alpine forests to fall unconscious. For a long time, he said, no matter how hard the hospital's medical staff tried, they had no survivors. Most of the victims had been without a pulse and oxygen for too long when they were found. But some, he was convinced, still had a flicker of viability in them. Yet he and his colleagues had always failed to sustain it. He took a close look at the case records. Preparation, he determined, was the chief difficulty. Success required having an array of people and equipment at the ready: trauma surgeons, a cardiac anesthesiologist, a cardiothoracic surgeon, bioengineering support staff, a cardiac perfusionist, operating and critical care nurses, intensivists. Almost routinely, someone or something was missing. He tried the usual surgical approach to remedy this, yelling at everyone to get their act together. But still, they had no saves. So he and a couple of colleagues decided to try something new. They made a checklist. They gave the checklist to the people with the least power in the whole process, the rescue squads and the hospital telephone operator, and walked them through the details.
In cases like these, the checklist said, rescue teams were to tell the hospital to prepare for possible cardiac bypass and rewarming. They were to call, when possible, even before they arrived on the scene, as the preparation time could be significant. The telephone operator would then work down a list of people to notify them to have everything set up and standing by. With the checklist in place, the team had its first success, the rescue of the 3-year-old girl. Not long afterward, Thalmann left to take a job at a hospital in Vienna. The team, however, has since had at least 2 other such rescues, he said. In one case, a man had been found frozen and pulseless after a suicide attempt. In another, a mother and her 16-year-old daughter were in an accident that sent them and their car through a guardrail, over a cliff, and into a mountain river. The mother died on impact. The daughter was trapped as the car rapidly filled with icy water. She had been in cardiac and respiratory arrest for a prolonged period of time when the rescue team arrived. From that point onward, though, everything moved like clockwork. By the time the rescue team got to her and began CPR, the hospital had been notified. The transport team delivered her in minutes. The surgical team took her straight to the operating room and crashed her onto heart-lung bypass. One step followed right after another, and because of the speed with which they did, she had a chance. As the girl's body slowly rewarmed, her heart came back. In the ICU, a mechanical ventilator, fluids, and intravenous drugs kept her going while the rest of her body recovered. The next day, the doctors were able to remove her lines and tubes. The day after that, she was sitting up in bed, ready to go home. Chapter 3. The End of the Master Builder. 4 generations after the first aviation checklists went into use, a lesson is emerging. Checklists seem able to defend anyone, even the experienced, against failure in many more tasks than we realized. They provide a kind of cognitive net. They catch mental flaws inherent in all of us, flaws of memory and attention and thoroughness. And because they do, they raise wide, unexpected possibilities. But they presumably have limits as well. So a key step is to identify which kinds of situations checklists can help with and which ones they can't. 2 professors who study the science of complexity, Brenda Zimmerman of York University and Shalom Glauberman of the University of Toronto, have proposed a distinction among 3 different kinds of problems in the world: the simple, the complicated, and the complex. Simple problems, they note, are like baking a cake from a mix. There is a recipe. Sometimes there are a few basic techniques to learn. But once these are mastered, following the recipe brings a high likelihood of success. Complicated problems are ones like sending a rocket to the moon. They can sometimes be broken down into a series of simple problems. But there is no straightforward recipe. Success frequently requires multiple people, often multiple teams, and specialized expertise. Unanticipated difficulties are frequent. Timing and coordination become serious concerns. Complex problems are ones like raising a child. Once you learn how to send a rocket to the moon, you can repeat the process with other rockets and perfect it. One rocket is like another rocket. But not so with raising a child, the professors point out. Every child is unique. Although raising one child may provide experience, it does not guarantee success with the next child. Expertise is valuable, but most certainly not sufficient. Indeed, the next child may require an entirely different approach from the previous one. And this brings up another feature of complex problems. Their outcomes remain highly uncertain. Yet we all know that it is possible to raise a child well. It's complex, that's all. Thinking about averting plane crashes in 1935, or stopping infections of central lines in 2003, or rescuing drowning victims today, I realized that the key problem in each instance was essentially a simple one, despite the number of contributing factors. one needed only to focus attention on the rudder and elevator controls in the first case, to maintain sterility in the second, and to be prepared for cardiac bypass surgery in the third. All were amenable, as a result, to what engineers call forcing functions, relatively straightforward solutions that force the necessary behavior, solutions like checklists. We are besieged by simple problems. In medicine, these are the failures to don a mask when putting in a central line, or to recall that one of the 10 causes of a flatline cardiac arrest is a potassium overdose. In legal practice, these are the failures to remember all the critical avenues of defense in a tax fraud case, or simply, the various court deadlines. In police work, these are the failures to conduct an eyewitness lineup properly, forgetting to tell the witness that the perpetrator of the crime may not be in the lineup, for instance, or having someone present who knows which one the suspect is. Checklists can provide protection against such elementary errors. Much of the most critical work people do, however, is not so simple. Putting in a central line is just one of the 178 tasks an ICU team must coordinate and execute in a day. ICU work is complicated. And are we really going to be able to create and follow checklists for every possible one of them? Is this even remotely practical? There is no straightforward recipe for the care of ICU patients. It requires multiple practitioners orchestrating different combinations of tasks for different conditions, matters that cannot be controlled by simple forcing functions. Plus, people are individual in ways that rockets are not. They are complex. No two pneumonia patients are identical. Even with the same bacteria, the same cough and shortness of breath, the same low oxygen levels, the same antibiotic, one patient might get better, and the other might not. A doctor must be prepared for unpredictable turns that checklists seem completely unsuited to address. Medicine contains the entire range of problems, the simple, the complicated, and the complex. And there are often times when a clinician has to just do what needs to be done. Forget the paperwork, take care of the patient. I have been thinking about these matters for a long time now. I want to be a good doctor for my patients. And the question of when to follow one's judgment and when to follow protocol is central to doing the job well, or to doing anything else that is hard. You want people to make sure to get the stupid stuff right. Yet you also want to leave room for craft and judgment and the ability to respond to unexpected difficulties that arise along the way. The value of checklists for simple problems seems self-evident. But can they help avert failure when the problems combine everything from the simple to the complex? I happened across an answer in an unlikely place. I found it as I was just strolling down the street one day. It was a bright January morning in 2007. I was on my way to work, walking along the sidewalk from the parking lot to the main entrance of my hospital, when I came upon a new building under construction for our medical center. It was only a skeleton of steel beams at that point, but it stretched 11 stories high, occupied a full city block, and seemed to have arisen almost overnight from the empty lot that had been there. I stood at one corner watching a construction worker welding a joint as he balanced on a girder 4 stories above me. And I wondered, how did he and all his co-workers know that they were building this thing right? How could they be sure that it wouldn't fall down? The building was not unusually large. It would provide 150 private hospital beds, so we could turn our main tower's old, mostly shared rooms into private beds as well, and 16 fancy new operating rooms, which I was especially looking forward to. Nothing out of the ordinary. I would bet that in the previous year, dozens of bigger buildings had been constructed around the country. Still, this one was no small undertaking, as the hospital's real estate manager later told me. The building, he said, would be 350,000 square feet in size, with 3 stories underground in addition to the 11 stories above. It would cost $360 million, fully delivered, and require 3,885 tons of steel, 13,000 yards of concrete, 19 air handling units, 16 elevators, 1 cooling tower, and 1 backup emergency generator. The construction workers would have to dig out 100,000 cubic yards of dirt and install 64,000 feet of copper piping, 47 miles of conduit, and 95 miles of electrical wire, enough to reach Maine. And, oh yeah, I thought to myself, this thing couldn't fall down. When I was 11 years old, growing up in Athens, Ohio, I decided I was going to build myself a bookcase. My mother gave me $10 and I biked down to the C&E hardware store on Richland Avenue. With the help of the nice man with hairy ears behind the counter, I bought 4 pine planks, each 8 inches wide and 3/4 inch thick, and cut to 4 feet long. I also bought a tin of stain, a tin of varnish, some sandpaper, and a box of common nails. I lugged the stuff home to our garage. I carefully measured my dimensions. Then I nailed the 2 cross planks into the 2 side planks and stood my new bookcase up. It looked perfect. I sanded down the surfaces, applied the stain, and soon the varnish. I took it to my bedroom and put a 6 books on it. Then I watched the whole thing fall sideways, like a drunk tipping over. The 2 middle boards began pulling out. So I hammered in a few more nails and stood the bookcase up again. It tipped over the other way. I banged in some more nails, this time coming in at an angle, thinking that would do the trick. It didn't. Finally, I just nailed the damn thing directly into the wall. And that was how I discovered the concept of bracing. So as I looked up at this whole building that had to stand up straight even in an earthquake, puzzling over how the workers could be sure they were constructing it properly, I realized the question had 2 components. First, how could they be sure that they had the right knowledge in hand? Second, how could they be sure that they were applying this knowledge correctly? Both aspects are tricky. In designing a building, experts must have to take into account a disconcertingly vast range of factors. The makeup of the local soil, the desired height of the individual structure, the strength of the materials available, and the geometry, to name just a few. Then, to turn the paper plans into reality, they presumably face equally Byzantine difficulties, making sure that all the different tradesmen and machinery do their job the right way, in the right sequence, while also maintaining the flexibility to adjust for unexpected difficulties and changes. Yet builders clearly succeed. They safely put up millions of buildings all over the globe. And they do so despite the fact that construction work has grown infinitely more complex over the decades. Moreover, they do it with a frontline workforce that regards each particular job, from pile driving to wiring intensive care units, much the way doctors, teachers, and other professionals regard their jobs, as specialized domains in which others should not interfere. I paid a visit to Joe Salvia, the structural engineer for our new hospital wing. I told him I wanted to find out how work is done in his profession. It turned out I'd come to the right person. His firm, McNamara Salvia, has provided the structural engineering for most of the major hospital buildings in Boston since the late 1960s. And for a considerable percentage of the hotels, office towers, and condominiums as well. It did the structural rebuilding of Fenway Park, the Boston Red Sox baseball team's 36,000-seat stadium, including the Green Monster, its iconic 37-foot home-run-stealing left-field wall. And the firm's particular specialty has been designing and engineering large, complicated, often high-rise structures all over the country. Salvia's tallest skyscraper is an 80-story tower going up in Miami. In Providence, Rhode Island, His firm built a shopping mall that required one of the largest steel mill orders placed on the East Coast, more than 24,000 tons. It is also involved in perhaps the biggest commercial project in the world, the Meadowlands Xanadu Entertainment and Sports Complex in East Rutherford, New Jersey, which will house a stadium for the New York Giants and New York Jets football teams, a 3,000-seat music theater, the country's largest movie multiplex, and the Snow Park, the nation's first indoor ski resort. For most of the past 7 years, McNamara Salvia's engineers have worked on 50 to 60 projects annually, an average of one new building a week. And they have never had a building come even close to collapsing. So I asked Salvia at his office in downtown Boston how he has ensured that the buildings he works on are designed and constructed right. Joe Salvia is 61, with almost no hair, a strong Boston accent, and a cheery, take-your-time-how-about-some-coffee manner that I didn't expect from an engineer. He told me about the first project he ever designed, a roof for a small shopping plaza. He was just out of college, a 23-year-old kid from East Cambridge, which is not exactly where the Harvard professors live. His father was a maintenance man, and his mother worked in a meat processing plant. But he was good in school and became the first member of his family to go to college. He went to Tufts University, planning to become a doctor. Then he hit organic chemistry class. They said, "Here, we want you to memorize these formulas," he explained. I said, "Why do I have to memorize them if I know where the book is?" They said, "You want to be a doctor? That's what you have to do in medicine. You have to memorize everything." That seemed ridiculous to me. Plus, I wasn't good at memorizing, so I quit. But Salvia was good at solving complex problems. He tried to explain how he solves quadratic equations in his head, though all I managed to pick up was that I'd never before heard someone say quadratic equation in a Boston accent. "I also like the concept of creating," he said. As a result, he switched to engineering, a scientific but practical field, and he loved it. He learned, as he put it,
"basic statics and dynamics, you know, F equals MA.
And he learned about the chemistry and physics of steel, concretes, and soil. But he'd built nothing when he graduated with his bachelor's degree and joined Sumner Shane, an architectural engineering firm that specialized in structural engineering for shopping centers. One of its projects was a new shopping mall in Texas, and Salvia was assigned,